Penguin Random House Audio presents To Die Beautiful, a novel by Buzzy Jackson, read for you by Saskia Marleveld. Dedicated to Rhoda and Leon F. Litwack, lives devoted to love and justice. I spent 5 years sitting next to her in class. She was very quiet, never joined in, and did not attend school parties. She never laughed and rarely smiled. But then, one time, somebody teased her. She reacted very fiercely. And that's when I realized, if you mess with this kitten, you better wear gloves. Cornelius Mall, on his high school classmate, Hani Schraft. I have a lot of respect for pacifists. I don't mean people who just profess to love peace. I mean those who stand up for their beliefs, because the world is currently drunk on war. Hani Schraft, excerpt from her high school essay, People I Admire. We would be starting a kind of secret army, and we were the only girls. Freddy Overstegen, on joining the Dutch resistance at age 14 with her sister, Truus. Historical note. Nazi Germany invaded the neutral Netherlands on 10th of May, 1940, destroying much of the historic city of Rotterdam in a blitzkrieg attack, and took power 5 days later. The fanatically anti-Semitic Austrian, Arthur Seyss-Inquart, who had colluded with Adolf Hitler in the Anschluss and Kristallnacht in 1938, was then appointed Reichskommissar, Reich Commissioner, of the Netherlands, setting in motion the terror to come. Anne Frank is the most famous victim of the Dutch Holocaust. Her story, resisting, hiding, betrayal, murder, was not unusual. More Jews were killed in the Netherlands than in any other Nazi-occupied European country. An estimated 75%, approximately 102,000 individuals, did not survive the war. To explain these numbers, survivors and historians have argued that the flat, densely populated geography of the Netherlands made it a difficult place in which to hide. There were no vast forests or mountain ranges into which one might disappear. Another factor in the Dutch experience might have been the relatively slow implementation of anti-Jewish measures by the Nazis in the Netherlands, which delayed the development of the resistance movement. Yet the Netherlands was also the site of the remarkable February strike of 1941, the first and only mass protest by non-Jews against anti-Semitic Nazi policies in Europe. Organized by the Dutch Communist Party, approximately 300,000 Dutch citizens mounted a huge nationwide general strike and demonstrations for 3 days, until it was violently put down by the Nazi occupiers, and dozens of the movement's organizers were killed. As the war went on, Dutch citizens engaged in forms of passive resistance, such as displaying the national color, orange, reading contraband resistance newspapers, and listening to Radio Oranje, the London-based radio programs of the exiled Dutch government. Among the general population of the Netherlands, approximately 5% are estimated to have openly collaborated with the Nazis. It is estimated that another 5% of the Dutch population participated in active resistance by sheltering Jews, spying on the Germans for the Allies, or taking up arms in direct confrontation with the Nazi occupiers. Of these armed resistors, only a few were women. Prologue, 1945. Amstel-Winseweg Prison, Amsterdam. You can walk right past your fate your whole life without seeing it, but prisons are inconspicuous by design. The Amstel-Winseweg Prison occupies an entire city block, hewn out of slabs of pitted gray stone, like something built for a pharaoh. I must have seen the building 1,000 times on my way to the university. Yet none of this is familiar. As I'm escorted into the central atrium, the air cools, the acoustics sharpen. Low whispers echo off soaring steel beams. If there are male captives here, I don't see them. Instead, women of all ages, from lanky teenagers to the hunched and elderly, are grouped by twos and threes in their cells, talking or praying, trying to sleep, heads snap up when I pass by, and I feel their eyes on me from behind. That's when the murmurs begin. The guards on either side of me tighten their grip, greedy fingers fanged around my upper arms.
"Mach,"
the guard says. "Keep going." We do, but the whispering slips past us like an incoming fog, rushing ahead into the hundreds of tiny cold cells stacked four stories high. With each step I take, the sound grows stronger, thicker, louder. The shuffle of women moving to the bars of their cells to watch, the clang of a shaken cell door, metal banging on metal. Something is growing. Somewhere high above me, I hear clapping.
"Ruhe,"
a guard above us says. "Silence." There is silence, for a moment. Then, across the atrium on another floor, two inspired souls let out a low whoop. The fog unfurls itself everywhere, swirling around us in the quietest of uproars, a floating, growing mist of righteousness. The sound of hope. Even here, in this place. By the time I reach the end of the walkway, the women are greeting me by name.
"Chani, Chani, het meisje met het rode haar, Chani Schaft."
The girl with the red hair, Chani. I don't acknowledge them. When I pass the last cell, I pause to look inside. An older woman with deep socketed eyes and long, uncombed hair rests on a cot, one knobby shoulder against the cell's cold wall for support. Her skin is ashen, and with her eyes closed, she looks dead. They slowly open. She sees me. I see her. Somehow this corpse lifts her claw of a trembling hand. I've never met her, but I know her. Too weak to stand, she raises one bony fist in salute.
"Verzet," she whispers.
"Resist. I intend to." Part 1. Ozo, 1940-1943, Amsterdam. Chapter 1. Autumn, 1940. I wasn't always an only child. Sitting on the chipped sink before me, the silver bird waits, frozen in flight, a silhouette like a bomber plane with two wings outstretched, tail swirling into a flirtatious spiral. A sparrow. I'd tried it on the last time I went to a music concert. Months ago. It was Annie's pin, of course. Father gave it to her after the real sparrow flew away. I was young, about 4 at the time, so Annie was 9. It had been after midnight, and I was asleep when Annie poked me in the arm.
"Johanna, look."
Holding a candle in one hand, she pointed with the other to the floor beside the bed we shared. There stood a small brown and gray bird, his head cocked to look at us as if listening to Annie's words. He peeped. I gasped, and Annie threw her hand across me.
"Shh. Let him fly out the window," I said. "I tried," she said, "but he flew right back in."
I didn't believe her. Peering over my sister's shoulder, I watched the ball of fluff bob and strut, his tiny claws a whisper on the floorboards. He finally fluttered up to the open window and flung himself outside.
"See," I said. "He's gone."
But half a second later, the bird was back at the window, flapping against the glass in a zigzag panic before slipping inside, landing, then hopping to his chosen spot on the floor beside our bed. He peeped at us again.
"What do we do with him?"
I asked.
"We keep him," Annie said.
Annie always knew the answer. We did keep him for a while. When he finally flew away for good, Father gave Annie the silver bird pin, a hand-me-down from our Oma. I was jealous, but it made sense. Annie was sparrow-like in her energy, her spark, her curiosity. They said Oma had been like that, too. A few months later, Father gave me my own pin, a small silver fox. It was brand new.
"Mein kleiner Wurz," he said. "For you."
My little fox.
"But I didn't find a fox," I said, confused. "Annie found the bird."
He laughed.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?